for Pacifica Radio, May 10th, 2015. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. You can find my full interview archive, more than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter, if you dare, at Scott Horton Show. Our guest this morning is Patrick L. Smith. He's the best writer at Salon.com and is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. He was the International Herald Tribune's bureau chief in Hong Kong and then Tokyo from 1985 to 1992. His latest piece is The Spotlight this weekend at antiwar.com. The New York Times does its government's bidding. Here's what you're not being told about U.S. troops in Ukraine. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, Scott. Thank you.
Very happy to have you back on the show here, and a very important article, and I sure am glad you're writing, because as you know, you're one of one handful of writers in America who's keeping up with the story of what's really going on in Ukraine and how Uncle Sam, if you want to call him that, got us into this mess. But first of all, today's VE Day, or I guess yesterday was VE Day, and they're doing a big celebration in Russia, and all the Western leaders are refusing to attend.
And right. I'm glad you began with that remark, Scott. This really has to count as an abominable disgrace. I don't want to overstate the case, but I don't think it's possible to overstate it. The Russians gave 27 million people to the defeat of the Nazis. And we are willing to dispense with that because we are having political disputes with them in the year 2015 that have nothing to do with it. Talk about the erasing of memory. It's just unjust at the very minimum and unappreciative.
I've read you, Patrick, and a few others remarking that nobody ever talked about Khrushchev, or never mind Uncle Joe Stalin, but Khrushchev and Andropov and the rest of the Soviet dictators during the bad old days of the USSR. The Americans never talked about them the way that they talk about Putin.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? In a column long back, I counted up. Not since Stalin has anybody been this thoroughly run into the ground. The common word is demonized, and it's good enough. And Stalin only after his Uncle Joe days were over, right? Why? Well, I did a long interview with Stephen Cohen, the Russianist, the other week, and he pointed out, I thought very astutely, demonizing Russia is a substitute for policy, right? We don't know what else to do, and it's a substitute for analysis. We don't have a policy over there other than to aggress as far, as close to the Russian border as we can. And what beyond that? I haven't heard a word as to what's supposed to happen then. I as I said in my column this past week, the one that got me on your show, and admittedly, it was quite a heated column. We are really playing with fire here now. Two nuclear powers coming this close to personnel contact. It's just thoughtless. Shocking.
Well, and see, that's the thing of it, too, right, is that the worst-case scenario is the extinction of mankind in a full-scale thermonuclear exchange or this kind of thing. And yet there's not too much gray area between sending troops to train Ukraine's army and screw around and maybe cause a war and total war. I mean, if there's a war, it's going to include H-bombs. There's no way for America to fight Russia and keep it conventional in any sense.
Well, I'll go with the verb could, right? And could is awful enough. Right, I, I, I think I would like to say to listeners, we're talking about several hundred people, several hundred Americans in uniform, at least several hundred announced, acknowledged. We don't know beyond that, and we can't sensibly have these sorts of conversations, Scott, on the assumption that we know everything. We really mustn't. So we have an acknowledged several hundred. All right, it's a small number. But look, as I encourage readers all the time, think with history. Don't forget how these things started in the past. Vietnam started with several hundred. Imagine back in the very early 50s, anybody saying, this will end with 4 million Vietnamese dead and 58,000 Americans. Who would have thought? One would have thought they were crazy, right? The Iraq War, look what it ballooned into. The pattern is very plain, and the pattern is what causes me to be so disturbed.
Well, and someone might get the impression, as you write in this article, that, well, it must not be that big of a deal, because when the New York Times mentions it at all, of course, they just blame everything on Russia, and they never give the real context, but they don't even pay that much attention to the story. And so, hey, it's just another training exercise in just another country. America trains armies all over the world. What difference does it make, is what the average person might think about this.
Right. Look, when President Obama sent several hundred Americans back to Iraq as advisors sometime last year, correct? Last summer? Okay. That was page A1 in the New York Times. We all remember that. That was a very big deal. We now send several hundred advisors, trainers, what have you, to in proximity of Russia's western border, which has been historically exceedingly sensitive border, and it's not news. It has been mentioned because it's the elephant in the living room. It has to be mentioned, right? True. But tiny little, the first Time story was on an inside page, more or less a brief with a byline. And I've spoken to any number of very informed friends since that column came out, and they say, gee, I didn't know. Well, that's the idea. We didn't know, right? I can't forgive the paper for that.
All right. Now, so if we could back up a little bit,
sure.
Patrick, again, it's Patrick L. Smith, great writer at Salon.com. What's Ukraine to Russia anyway?
It is, let's say, civilizationally important. All right. Russian, what do we want to call it, heritage culture, is intimately connected with Kiev and extends far back into history. More recently, so there's language, there's culture, there's history, there's shared traditions, there's familial ties. Remember when things went haywire in eastern Ukraine and a million people were displaced. You won't read this, but the very great majority of them went back to Russia, right? That ought to tell us something, all right, about the intimacy of this relationship. Now, we have to address the geopolitics of it too, surely, all right? My position on this is as follows. Spheres of influence are 19th century technologies. They were never very attractive. During the colonial era, when they would have, in many people's minds, reached their sort of high point, they were pretty ugly. Of course, we all know that. But my view is, no, that's not when spheres of influence came fully into their own. The Cold War was basically the division of the planet into spheres of influence. Now, these are undesirable concepts. I call it just a bad, outdated technology. So My view is we must, but they are realities, especially given the eastern advance of NATO and other such things, right? And in my view, the Cold War never really ended. I've said that numerous times. So what do we do in a sensible policy design? We must observe spheres of influence without honoring them. Everybody knows they are not attractive, and it's our job in the 21st century to ditch them. But we haven't yet. As numerous people say, reverse this situation and think just for a second what would happen. We would have perhaps the Russians active in the Yucatan Peninsula, right? And we go back a mere half a century to the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's no ambiguity about this, right? And so we have deep historical cultural ties, and then we have more recently the really regrettable East-West tensions and our failure in the 21st century to advance beyond these. They are realities. Mm-hmm. One more remark, Scott, if sure. I may. Look, the Times coverage is one does have to say, purposefully misleading at this point, and that's why my ire was stirred in that last column such that it was. Look, the trainers arrived in mid-April. We had a Pentagon announcement, I think, the 16th of April. It's in the record. A week or two later, we had a report from Washington, the State Department, the inimitable Marie Harf, the State Department, the hack who does the State Department's announcements, saying the Russians are amassing troops again on their border. Putin is, of course, amassing troops on his western border. All right. And he said 2 weeks ago that the presence of our trainers would destabilize the situation. Here's the failure. No causality was ever suggested in the news coverage. We are being led to think that the presence of these troops there should have absolutely no bearing on Moscow's thinking. It's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. And it's an abandonment of responsibility, speaking as a professional practitioner, for the Times to put this stuff across as sort of wide-eyed innocence, right? We decline. This is an old habit in Washington, and it runs all through our media coverage of these sort of situations. Absolutely allergic to notions of causality. Why did this happen? How did A, B, and C line up? You never get it, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is an important point that you make, too, about how it's not Russia or Moscow or the Kremlin. It's Putin does this and Putin
right.
does that. Personalizing everything onto him makes it
right.
where anything we do to them is okay. And we saw the same thing from, you know, Noriega to Koresh to Hussein, that you can kill whoever might be around them if you just demonize the one guy enough or get away
yeah,
with whatever murder.
It's the manipulation of consciousness. It's the manipulation of our awareness. It is the manipulation of our way of thinking about these things. And you get just venomous hatred from ordinary Americans who ought to know better, but they have been, this has been sort of drummed into them. I mean, media are exceedingly powerful. Every advertising executive from Edward Bernays onward can tell you that. You can get people to think whatever you want them to think. And this is dangerous. This is a component of our danger in that we are so vastly uninformed. Go to the European press and you get an entirely different accounting of these things. I find it I find it a bit frightening that 320 million Americans can be this kept this thoroughly in the dark on these matters. It's not healthy.
Right. Okay, now, so again, we're talking with Patrick L. Smith from Salon.com. The article is New York Times Does Its Government's Bidding. Here's what you're not being told about U.S. troops in Ukraine. So let me ask you, what are these guys thinking about expanding NATO? You know, John Mearsheimer wrote in Foreign Affairs that, you know, great job with your academic exercise about just how neat and nice it's going to be to expand the EU and NATO. On top of that, the military alliance that includes America all the way to Russia's borders. You said it wouldn't anger the Russians, and look, now it did. But so what is the point of this thing? I mean, I used to think that they would bring in the Russians. They had the Russian NATO Council and stuff. They would end up bringing the Russians in and then sell them on our missile defense and whatever and make the kind of one world army of the North, this kind of thing. Never did that. But they can't possibly, Patrick, really think that they're going to get a regime change in Russia or break Russia apart into pieces without having a nuclear war first. And so what in the hell do they think they're doing? Seriously.
When hyper-rationality tips into irrationality, okay? In my view, Putin's rise in Russia altered thinking in Washington very profoundly. After the Soviet Union ended and then was dismembered by Yeltsin, all the wealth distributed to oligarchs and so forth, it became clear Putin inherited a catastrophic domestic situation, right? And it had become clear by then that the partnership proffered at the end of the Cold War didn't really mean an equal partnership. It meant now that we have won the Cold War, a mistaken concept to begin with, you may come along with us and follow in our footsteps, right? You will have a free market economy, and you will be grateful for it. And in these sorts of ways, you will cooperate, as a very prominent Russian essayist, poet, actually, wrote to Havel in Prague at this time. All the Indians are now supposed to imitate the cowboys. That was the concept. And Putin has made it clear that he's not interested in that. And I think rightfully so. One can find all manner of things wrong with Putin's style of government and administration. Fine. They don't really... you have your secondary contradiction and your primary contradiction, okay? His treatment of the press, gay rights, and so on and so forth, that doesn't have to do with what we're talking about now. What we're talking about now is a leader who insists that, no, you may not extend neoliberal economics and NATO up to our border. And no, you are not welcome to threaten the regime, what we are attempting to do here in Moscow, right? That's my view of Putin in his primary manifestation now. The domestic stuff is not our business. That's for Russians to address, right? That's my response to this query.
Now, so, but I wonder whether you think, and I've heard this analogy made a couple of different ways, but what about the idea that right now this is Weimar Russia, despite what Hillary Clinton says about Putin being Hitler? You know, hey, this guy could die of cancer in 6 months or something. I don't know. And then who comes after him? Or maybe there's, remember he went on vacation with his girlfriend for a week and everybody freaked out like there was some kind of coup? Well,
ridiculous.
What if there was? And what if people far to the right of Putin come next?
Right. It's a corollary to your previous question, and I'm glad you returned to it in this way. We don't have a forward plan, all right? We've done this over and over and over again. We didn't have a forward plan when we knocked over Saddam Hussein, and it's pretty hard to make Saddam Hussein look good, but we managed to do so over the next 10 years, didn't we? We don't have a forward plan for any kind of post-Putin regime change whatsoever. And most saliently, Scott, we are deluded in the assumption that we can win this Ukraine crisis, that we can resolve it our way. There is no way under the sun that Moscow is going to tolerate a Western success in Ukraine, the installation of NATO facilities and so forth. Just forget it. They will go to the mat on this. And we just don't seem to get that. Mm-hmm. We just don't seem to get that. They will go all the way, just as we would if a reverse situation were to occur in our hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in your article here at Salon.com, you talk about the sensitive history. I think you mentioned before in the interview, too, the sensitive history of Ukraine and Russia, in the sense that not just are they very close countries in terms of geography and longtime history going back, America to Canada or America to Mexico, that kind of thing.
Right.
But they've been invaded by way of Ukraine more times than anybody can count, I guess.
Yes. You know, it's again, this border with Europe, the Europe, let's say, the Europe-facing border, is very, very sensitive real estate. Why policy thinkers cannot factor this in to their considerations is absolutely beyond me. Is it some kind of sign of weakness to say, this justly or unjustly is a problem? We better observe the sensitivities. We're just not there. We are, in a certain way, deluded as to our own unchallengeable power, right? We're going to get a bloody nose here. I said a year ago, we will retreat on Ukraine one way or another, and I hope we are forced to sooner rather than later. There is a perfectly good solution in Ukraine, and you don't have to have left, right, or center politics to understand its virtue. The country's natural divisions, its location between East and West, are perfect for a federalized Ukraine. There is only one thing wrong with that idea. Vladimir Putin thinks it's sensible, too.
Yeah. So, in other words, they could work it out, and they don't want that. They prefer
crisis.
They
could work it out in less than a week. And one of the hidden aspects of the current agenda, Scott, make no mistake, the Germans and the French and others in Europe are very eager for a negotiated settlement of the kind I just described. That's why there were ceasefire talks in Minsk twice. We are now living in what we call Minsk II, an imperfect ceasefire, but the best we got right now.
Well, now, right? So back to the beginning then, Patrick, is it the case that the reason the Americans are sending weapons and trucks and all this military gear and money and special forces to train their National Guard, who, I'm sorry, we didn't have time to get to the fact that we're training their National Guard, not their army, but their National Guard, who are at least in great measure a bunch of Nazis. Are they doing
to undermine
Minsk, too? Is that the purpose of this?
Yes, that's what I was about to say. The hidden, one hidden purpose of these troops there is to... It is an act of resistance against European efforts for a negotiated settlement. We do not want a negotiated settlement. We do not want a compromise. We don't understand that word. It's not in our vocabulary. We were very upset with Minsk too. Please note, listeners, we weren't invited for a very good reason. And it was structured with Putin's people. Well, Putin himself was right there. Mm-hmm. This was done. This is what people are working toward. And at this moment, we send troops in to train. Think it over. Our fronts in this conflict are two. One is with Russia, and the other, more quietly, is with Chancellor Merkel's efforts toward a negotiated settlement.
Right. Well, and, you know, she even came to America first, right? And read Obama the Riot Act, said, stay out of this. I'm going to make this peace deal. Did I read that right?
Yes, you did. Get the chronology correct. It's a little micro, but I'll do my best. There was an announcement in Washington. Let's vote to send weapons to Ukraine. The Europeans quaked. All right, that was on a Monday. Secretary of State Kerry announced instantly he's going to Kiev. He was due to arrive that Thursday. All right. It was plain what he was going to discuss. That Wednesday, Chancellor Merkel called François Hollande in Paris and said, get yourself a plane ticket. We're going to Kiev and we're going on from there to Moscow. A completely improvised trip. And that was when Minsk II was planned and subsequently signed. And so at that point, Merkel had said to the Americans, absolutely no on the weaponry. Absolutely no. We were forced to observe that. We have been to date. And what's the next move? Trainers. Okay, no weaponry, but trainers.
And plenty of trucks and other military equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the non-lethal bit, mm-hmm. right? Goggles and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, although dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of trucks, that can make a bit of a difference on the battlefield. It's not nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, I hate to do this to you, Patrick, but I got to end this interview soon, and I'm going to end it on a point made by Henry Kissinger, for crying out loud, which was, he said, look at the timing of what all happened here. Putin was holding the Sochi Olympics just to make the case. Look how European we are. Look how much like you we are. And it doesn't make sense that, you know, America's narrative here that the Russians are the aggressors and picked this fight. And he doesn't quite get into the coup d'etat, but we all know what he's talking about there.
Right.
And so that really is the point, though, that I wanted to let you address would be, what if it hadn't have been for the coup and America's aggression and adventurism in Ukraine, what was the Russian stance? What exactly was Putin trying to do, not just with Sochi, but overall in terms of his relationship with the EU and the Americans before they blew it up?
This will go down very bitterly with some of your listeners, but the reality is that Putin has had his hand across the water all along. His stipulation is, and I think perfectly just, we all insist on the same thing in every relationship we have. His stipulation is, let us cooperate. We are equals. This is a multipolar world. This is what we will not accept.
All right, y'all, that is Patrick L. Smith. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and he writes a great column at Salon.com. Thank you very much for your time again on the show, Patrick.
A pleasure, Scott. Good questions.
All right, y'all, that again is Patrick L. Smith at Salon.com, and that's it for Anti-War Radio for this morning. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Scott Horton, here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., kpfk.org. You can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. See you next week.